Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over the God's green world.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We got a great show today, we got some stuff to celebrate fantastically, and then we got to mourn and talk in depth about Fukushima. I have two fantastic people with me today, the great Deb Katz of the Citizens Awareness Network in Vermont and Massachusetts, well, New England, let's call it a New England regional group, and Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, two of the stalwarts of the multi-decade, that's four multis there, grassroots anti-nuclear movement in this country. Deb and Paul, can I hear your voices?
Got us, or you got me.
Yeah, no nukes, Harvey.
All right, no nukes, Paul. Fantastic. And on this show, you can call me Sluggo. So we're gonna move ahead with the Sluggo Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Let's start with the good news, and there is good news. We want to celebrate the impending and hard-fought and justly won shutdown of the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. Deb Katz, you have been on this case. You're very, very young. You're still a teenager, of course, but you've been on this a long, long time. Tell us about the shutdown of Vermont Yankee and what that means for all of us.
Well, I think it's really a very important step in terms of a kind of strategic campaign that was focused on trying to figure out who were the decision makers and who could make a difference in this. You know, CAN had shut down or was instrumental in shutting down three nukes, and then we started working on Vermont Yankee, and it was a very tough nut to crack, as a lot of activists before us who have worked long and hard dealt with, including Paul Gunter here.
Right, and Paul being the tallest guy in the New England anti-nuclear movement.
To change the way we approach this, because we had felt that there was no satisfaction possible from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that they would never close another nuke again. They were now in the business of basically supporting a failing industry. We began a states' rights campaign with other groups in Vermont and in the tri-state community, focused on getting the state of Vermont, the Vermont legislature, to actually make the choice to not support the renewal of Entergy, which owns the plant, Vermont Yankee's license in 2012. And this was an on-the-ground grassroots movement, year after year, knocking on doors, getting people to call their legislators, thousands of people calling legislators. We got the vote in 2010 that the legislature would not support the continued operation. And this was a state process, and went through a number of lawsuits with Entergy, stopped them from getting a power contract. Basically, we came out and went back to the NRC, which almost drove us mad, with a petition about Entergy's financial insecurity in May. And actually, Beyond Nuclear and Paul Gunter joined that, and we began saying that there was a conflict between the continued operation of Vermont Yankee, Fitzpatrick, and the Pilgrim Reactor and safety. The NRC actually accepted the petition, which is relatively rare, and they did that at the end of August, and 2 weeks later, the reactor closed. We don't.
Well, that's a fantastic victory, Deb. Now, you mentioned Deb Katz, Citizens Awareness Network in Western Massachusetts, all too close to the Vermont Yankee plant. We did successfully in 1991 shut down the Yankee Row plant, which is like in your backyard.
Yes.
And then we also got the cancellation, which was operating. At the time, the Yankee Row plant was the oldest reactor in the United States. There's no operating reactor. There's no doubt that it was citizen action that shut Yankee Row, because at the time, as you'll recall, both you and Paul will remember, Ivan Selin was going to be coming in as the new chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and we as a movement got to the then chairman of the House Subcommittee on Energy and Environment, who's from Pennsylvania. His name escapes me at the moment. And he had Ivan Selin in front of him. I actually sat right next to Ivan Selin at that hearing, and he challenged Ivan Selin to force the operators of Yankee Row to do a test on the core of the Yankee Row plant before they reopened it. It had been hit by lightning, as you'll recall, and Selin clearly couldn't deliver, and they shut Yankee Row
that same night.
What's that?
Both of them. It was an act of God. It knocked out the control, the ability for the Yankee Atomic to communicate with the outside world, but it also hit Vermont Yankee on the same night.
Well, clearly God is a member of the Clamshell Alliance. Would you agree with that, Paul Gunter, of Beyond Nuclear?
Oh, absolutely. I think that we've always understood that Clam Magic has allies that are unseen, and but nevertheless, serendipity is on our side.
Yes, and now,
look,
we also, of course, in recent weeks have shut two reactors at Santa Onofre.
It was the hard work of ordinary people that shut five nukes at this point in the Northeast and New England. And if it hadn't been for that, the whole notion of economics wouldn't have come up, because the issues would have been hidden.
Well, tell us about that, Paul Gunter. How do you assess the role of citizen action in shutting these nuclear plants? You know, San Onofre 2 reactors will not reopen there. We've shut Crystal River, Kewaunee in Wisconsin all this year, and now Vermont Yankee. What is the act? You know, lots of commentators like to dismiss citizen action, say it's all economics. Give us, from your national perspective, you have a unique a blend of national and grassroots experience. Give us your take on the role that citizen action really plays in shutting these nuclear plants.
Well, in short, it's really about truth force and how the power of the people raising their voice, marching in the streets, illuminating the problems and crimes, and how this translates into political power, and you know, I think it's very much part of the history of the United States, but you know, we've seen it elsewhere, where when the people lead, the leaders will follow, and I think that that's a clear example here in the nuclear power issue.
Well, tell us now, Deb. You know, in a matter of moments, brief moments, Deb summarized a campaign that took decades to get the state of Vermont from the bottom up, from the grassroots up, all the way to the state legislature, to win a 26-4 victory in the state Senate that eventually boxed Entergy into a corner. Deb, can you give us a little more, just a sort of a history of what it took to get the state of Vermont to the point where it could finally push Entergy into a corner from which Entergy could not escape?
There was a summit that groups held in northern Vermont when Entergy began the process of applying for relicensing. And the choice was made to take on this corporation on the basis of a certificate of public good. See, there's a bifurcated process in terms of dealing with nuclear power. NRC deals with safety, but states deal with economics, the environment, a whole list of things that they can choose to reject a nuclear reactor operating within their border. With that in mind, we, in fact, worked with legislators to get what's called Act 160 passed in 2006, which empowered the Vermont legislature to decide whether Entergy, in fact, could get a license from the state to continue to operate after its license expired in 2012. What we then did with other groups was a massive door-by-door, town-by-town, you know, county-by-county process of getting people to realize the power that they had to actually get the legislature to reject Entergy's ability to move forward. And, you know, originally this act was passed under Governor Douglas, a Republican that supported Entergy, and Entergy supported the bill because they could never believe that citizen power was going to actually be able to get a vote in 2010 against them. And I have to say they helped a lot, because between their endless leaks and lies, their lying before the state legislature, the public service board, in which they swore up and down about things that proved to be false, they helped our case. But it was that legislative vote in 2010, and even though Entergy then went to court against that, the reality was even when they won the lawsuit, each lawsuit they won, there were bombs in the lawsuit. And the lawsuit that they won in appellate court, the appellate court made it clear that the state has the right to reject Entergy's continued operation, just not on the basis of safety. And that was a nail in their coffin.
Well, let's talk about that for a second.
It kept going on that the state blocked them and the people blocked them at every turn.
Let's talk about that for a second, Deb. First of all, I want to say, and Paul, you're certainly aware of this, Deb Katz is sort of narrating here a battle, a war that went on for decades. And everything you mentioned, the summit, the legal cases, all that took enormous amounts of grassroots organizing, fundraising, meetings, bake sales, concerts, rallies, door-to-door campaigning, all the things that go into grassroots campaigns. I mean, if there's ever a model for four decades of grassroots campaigning resulting finally in a victory, it's the Vermont Yankee fight. I mean, I remember when I lived in Montague, Massachusetts, we printed up the first bumper stickers that said "Dismantle Yankee Row" and "Vermont Yankee." That was in 1974, for God's sakes. So it took us 17 years to dismantle, get Yankee Row shut down, and almost 40 to get Vermont Yankee shut down. And it's still operating, of course, until the end of next year, God willing. I mean, let's hope nothing bad happens in the meantime. Well, I'd like to see it shut. But Paul Gunter, can you comment on the depth of organizing that all this takes and the dedication?
Well, it's I remember when we first got started with the Clamshell Alliance, looking at a construction project on the New Hampshire seacoast at the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, and the actions that were to focus on mobilizing mass civil disobedience around a construction project, several of us started on the other side of the state in July of 1976 with a horse-drawn wagon that had a puppet show in the back of the wagon called Burnt Toast, Trouble in the Nation's Breadbasket. And we started that in Winchester, New Hampshire, I believe it was July 21st, 1976. We were canvassing door to door, and that very day, Vermont Yankee, which had only been operating about 4 years at that time, dumped 80,000 gallons of radioactive water into the Connecticut River. So as we were canvassing, Vermont Yankee began the spewing of radioactive waste into the Connecticut River. And those events that followed in succession, you know, were part of this whole process that illuminated that this is an inherently dangerous technology, that it is unforgiving when it fails, and that it is that in fact the technology is protected by the government, and that so when you mobilize a people at the grassroots, you're mobilizing a democratic process for an industry that is the antithesis of democracy. It requires to be hidden from the public. It requires secrecy. It requires the government ignoring its own regulations, and in fact, refusing to enforce its own regulations. So the level of mobilizing begins with this process of education, mobilization, and then the grinding of people power that ultimately persuades the powers that be, including the corporate boardrooms where this decision was made. But the corporate boardroom decision was not made in a vacuum. It was made with the people in the streets, in the legislative lobby process, and even on March 22nd, 2012, it was March 23rd, 2012, the first day that Vermont Yankee began to operate illegally in terms of state law, we had, more than 100 people arrested at the Vermont Yankee headquarters, and as well as in the corporate boardroom, in the corporate headquarters in New Orleans, at the executive headquarters of Entergy.
Well, we had over 1,200 people in the street that day as well.
Indeed.
So, I mean, there was more, but I want to raise something in this, because it was one of the things that really worked in Vermont for us, which was we didn't fight them on how bad the nukes were. We really didn't, because we felt that people knew how bad the nukes were for the most part, and they felt completely helpless and despairing that they could do anything about it. What we gave them was a sense of hope that there was something worth fighting for. And what was worth fighting for was this opportunity that the state had to reject this corporation continuing to operate within Vermont for another 20 or 40 years. So we didn't fight it on how bad they were or drive people nuts with the terrible things the industry does, because it got us to the point where all we wanted to do was drink, and we didn't feel if we gave that to people, they would want to do anything but drink either. The fact was we created a campaign about what was possible and gave people effective tools and things they could do to actually change the course of history.
Yes, and you did change the course of history. Let me jump in here real quick. We're talking with Deb Katz of the Citizens Awareness Network of Western Massachusetts, Western New England, a group that's been deeply involved in the 40-year grassroots battle to shut Vermont Yankee, which has just been won. Vermont Yankee will shut no later than the end of next year, hopefully sooner and hopefully not with an accident. And we're talking with Paul Gunter at the Beyond Nuclear in Washington. Paul, a co-founder of the Clamshell Alliance, long, long time anti-nuclear activist and the tallest man in the anti-nuclear movement, I believe, in the entire region of New England. Deb, of course, we know that medical marijuana is legal in Vermont. You could have applied for medical purposes to smoke
in
a little of that after.
In Massachusetts as well.
To relieve the stress of fighting Vermont Yankee, but now you can celebrate with it, I suppose. One of the points I want to get at, in the second half hour, I'm going to talk with Paul about this ridiculous disinfomercial called Pandora's Promise, out promoting nuclear power, and then we're going to get to the really hardcore nightmare of what's going on in Fukushima. But with Deb here, I want to celebrate Vermont Yankee and really lay out, you know, we have still 99 reactors in this country, commercial reactors in this country to shut down, although there's some speculation Fort Calhoun in Nebraska, which has been flooded, won't reopen. What lessons do you want to give people, grassroots organizers, both of you, about this victory, this incredibly hard-fought victory at Vermont Yankee?
Well, I think that part of it is really thinking outside the box. That's what we attempted to do in this. I mean, we actually think that there's a good chance that Fitzpatrick will close in New York. Entergy is already negotiating over Indian Point. Entergy is a corporation that's in terrible financial trouble in terms of each of these limited liability corporations they've set up. But the issue is really to see if there is traction on a state level to get the state and the legislature and the attorney generals involved in the process. One of the things about Vermont, which may not be so easy to translate, but maybe, is it was a small state, and we could cover the state, grassroots groups working hard because we could be on the ground doing it. In larger states, that can be harder, but it is really effective work, and the bang for the buck is enormous because state legislators, at least in Vermont, get elected every 2 years. So the issues of what come up affect people directly and can affect legislators directly. And when they start getting a lot of calls, they listen. I remember I was with Michael Marriott. We had been on tour, on a high-level waste tour, gone through Nebraska. We were in Washington at this point. And a legislator came up to Michael and said, "You know, I got so many calls in Nebraska on the high-level waste issue, I was really shocked." You know, and Michael and I are looking at each other, and I remember we went through and we had a couple of stops, but, you know, what are we talking about? And Michael asked, he said, "How many calls did you get?" He said, "8."
Right.
Eight
well,
calls.
That's a lot in a state like Nebraska. And
that's a lot in a
Vermont,
state like Nebraska, but
now.
It gives you a sense of what people organized and engaged can do. And this is, they'll always say it's economics that closed the nuke. They said it about Roe. They said it about Connecticut Yankee. They said it about Millstone. I'm sure they said it about Maine Yankee. But it was the people that closed all of those nukes, as well as the nukes in California. There is no doubt. And they'll continue to close.
What do you want to say about that?
Well, you know, I think we also have to remember that Vermont Yankee was given a 20-year license extension on March 10th, 2011. The very next day, Fukushima started melting down. I mean, that had an incredible wake-up call for not only the people of New England, but all across and all around the world. You know, these plants are getting older. And, in fact, they've always been sitting ducks as well in terms of they are tremendous security risks. So illuminating the, you know, Deb is correct that, you know, the plant, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear utility claimed that it was only economic decisions that influenced the boardroom for pulling the plug on Vermont Yankee. But in fact, the tremendous cost of safety and environmental impact from this dirty, dangerous, and expensive industry, these all add up to the sum total of that economics. And, you know, while gas, fracking is cheap now, you can't just look at these closures in terms of economic weight alone, because Fukushima has a tremendous cost now, where these plants have to look at containment systems that don't work, you know, where the radioactive cores are now known to be vulnerable to meltdown. If you lose power, from any number of events. So we're seeing now the sum total of an inherently dangerous, dirty, expensive industry that's getting older and more fragile, and margins are thinner, and events are coming. So,
well, Deb Katz, what is your plan now, Paul? You and I are gonna be on this for the second half hour. We're gonna talk a lot more about Fukushima, but Deb, I know you have to leave.
Right.
What is your plan now, having this tremendous grassroots success in Vermont, for shutting Pilgrim in Massachusetts? You are, after all,
you know, you're so damn ambitious. We haven't even put this one to bed, and we're going to start struggling over how they're going to clean it up and when they're going to get the high-level waste out of the pool. So there is a lot of work to do there that is not yet done. There are a lot of good people working around Pilgrim at this point. We're actually thinking about where we can be helpful next. You know, we are also thinking about Fitzpatrick at this point, in terms of there are people working around there who have talked to us about helping some with that. So we will see, but this is not yet done. We have to hold them accountable to actually clean the site up, because at this point what Entergy wants to do is mothball the reactor for 60 years. I mean, this is a whole other program, which is they don't have enough money to clean the site up, nor do they have enough money to actually move the high-level waste out of the pool. This is a corporation that's going to operate for the next 14 months with workers leaving, with a real conflict between the amount of money they have and safety. So there's still some work to do before we move on to something else.
There's also
I understand, but I know you want to jump in, Paul, but I know my crew here in New York City, where PRN is based and from which we're broadcasting, would be very interested to know what the impacts of this are on the two reactors at Indian Point.
They're enormous, because Entergy is already starting to negotiate, and Indian Point is the jewel in the crown. And even the jewel in the crown, basically the reactor that is subsidizing and keeping all these other second-rate reactors in New England and New York operating, they're talking about potentially selling it if they can get their money back, selling it to the state in some bizarre way. This
How
is
much?
A corporation that's on the ropes.
How
and
much
that
money
makes
are they asking
all
for?
The nukes in New England and New York vulnerable, as well as, you know, out west where they're, I think, managing Cooper at this point.
How much money do they want for Indian Point?
Oh, God, I don't remember. It was a lot. I mean, they bought it from the Power Authority. It's a lot of money, and I don't know if the state will agree to it, but they actually threw that out at the point that they said they were closing Vermont Yankee. And there may be a deal to cut on Fitzpatrick in all of this. I mean, this is a corporation that is going under, and this is really dangerous. The NRC has never dealt with the situation before. These are merchant reactors, merchant corporations that have no ability to go back like utilities to get more money, to deal with safety issues, to deal with decommissioning, to deal with the storage of high-level waste. They are these individual little entities in a kind of bizarre system, you know, under Entergy management, where it is hard to actually find out who is really responsible and who has to come up with the money in the long run to bail these individual nukes out.
All right, so I propose we do a bake sale, we raise enough money to buy Indian Point, and we declare bankruptcy.
Hey, look,
we shut the plant
down.
We
had bake
sales
for our lobbyists, you know, and they really worked. We raised an enormous amount of money through those bake sales, but I don't think we can run enough of them to actually bail Entergy out. They bet the wrong horse. They bet the wrong horse going into New England and New York, where they never thought they'd feel the opposition they have, and they bet the wrong horse in terms of nukes and coal.
talking with Deb Katz here of the Citizens Awareness Network. Deb's going to have to be leaving us in a couple of minutes, and also Paul Gunter, who's going to stay with us. Paul's from the Beyond Nuclear organization in Washington, and a veteran of many, many years of grassroots organizing. Second half hour, we're going to talk about Pandora's promise, this ridiculous disinfomercial about nukes, and about Fukushima. Deb, you got a couple of last words for us before we go to the break.
Look, it's really possible. It's possible to shut a local nuke. It's possible for democracy to work. People have to believe it, and they have to commit themselves to risking losing everything to win. That's what it takes. And the people of the tri-state community risked everything to bring this win about. So.
Well, fantastic. And Deb, you deserve an incredible amount of credit. I know how hard you work. And I know that when you walk into a hearing room, the utility executives really have to run to the men's room. So,
well, they don't like me much. It's true.
Well, they like you more now. You saved them a ton of money by getting them shut
earlier.
I did.
You know, they actually, we thought they were going to lose $125 million over the next 3 years. They said in their press release they were saving $200 million. I just saved them $200 million. How about
that? Well, I hope the check's in the mail to you, Deb Katz. And I can't praise you enough. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Harvey.
Coming on
the show. Thank you, Paul. Have a good show.
Hey, no nukes.
No nukes.
Paul, no nukes. And, Paul, you'll be with us through the break. We're going to hear Dana Lyons do the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home to me.
All right, that's the wonderful Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame. Over 2 million hits on his Cows with Guns YouTube there. I highly recommend you go see it. Singing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We've had a wonderful half hour with Paul Gunter and Deb Katz. Deb, a stalwart of the successful movement, the 40-year grassroots movement to shut the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant. Lots and lots of stuff left to do there. Great advice on how to run a grassroots campaign if you've got the stamina to go at it for 4 decades, which she certainly has. We're with Paul Gunter, another great grassroots campaigner, and also working in Washington, D.C. now at the Vermont Beyond Nuclear Organization. Paul, a pleasure to have you on. You have actually seen this ridiculous disinfomercial. Well, I shouldn't call it ridiculous. I haven't seen it. Disinfomercial called Pandora's Promise. Have you not?
Absolutely. There was a very limited showing around the United States of the Robert Stone's Pandora's Promise, which is basically a one-sided promotion commercial for more nuclear power.
And what it's really got me speechless because they won't send me a review copy. I called, I talked, I'm in the film somewhere. Someone told me I'm yelling in a bullhorn somewhere in this film.
Yeah,
I am. Can you hear what I'm saying?
They have got you saying the F word. They have you asking permission from the folks. I think it's in New York. If you can say the F word. So what they've done is they've taken some very select cuts of a group of activists from various presentations, and they've completely taken them out of context and painted you, Helen Caldicott, and some others in off moments or out of context moments to trivialize the message of the safe energy movement and those who have opposed nuclear power now for 40 years, and basically to paint us as extremists, lunatics, or Luddites even, and to paint a picture for what we're now experiencing is a nuclear retreat of this industry. It's crumbling. The dominoes are falling. Vermont Yankee, its falling is now leaning on Fitzpatrick, on Pilgrim, on many more reactors. And this film is part of an industry effort pretty much orchestrated by groups like the Breakthrough Institute in a last-ditch effort to resurrect this crumbling, dangerous, exorbitantly expensive, and highly radioactive nuclear industry.
Well, I assume when you say they have me saying, asking permission to say the F word, I'm sure we're referring to fascism. Is that correct?
Yes.
I mean, I haven't seen the thing. They won't send it to me, as I say, and I'm going to try and see it somewhere at some high school. I guess they're going around the country with this film, showing it in high schools. Is that right?
We just are organizing a rebuttal in Austin, Texas, to a high school there in Austin. So they've now cleared the theatrical productions where they were in a limited number of theaters. It was really an atomic bomb in the theater screenings, and now they're moving into high school. Soon it will be. They're planning a showing on CNN in November. It'll be in Netflix.
Well, your Beyond Nuclear organization has posted a petition, which I have linked at nukefree.org, asking CNN. Well, tell us, what are you asking CNN to do about the showing of this film?
Well, one of CNN's many themes is keeping them honest, as they say on one of their news hours, and so we're asking CNN to base as they show this Pandora's promise, or as we reference it, Pandora's false promise. We think that this is they're turning CNN into a shopping channel for nukes, and it's really now their responsibility to add some rebuttal or discussion with truly independent experts that can then discuss the misrepresentations that are the foundation of the premise in Pandora's promise that nuclear power holds out hope for climate change, which is in fact it will accelerate our demise if we invest in the wrong solution, a solution that's already had four decades to show that there is no more expensive way to boil water than nuclear power, and at the same time, using uranium. Uranium is the currency of a coin whose flip side is nuclear waste on one side and nuclear weapons on the other. They are inextricably connected. And so to talk about a global solution to climate with nuclear power, we're ultimately talking about the most expensive way and ultimately the transfer of nuclear weapons materials. And to go from global warming to nuclear winter is no solution.
Yeah. So we're talking with Paul Gunter here. Paul is from the Beyond Nuclear Organization in Washington, D.C. He has actually seen this film, Pandora's Promise. I saw YouTube, and his organization has posted a petition to CNN to get at least equal time. I posted the link at nukefree.org. I saw YouTube with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., just about strangling the guy who made this thing.
Robert Stone.
He called it an elaborate hoax. Now, I understand that Bobby Kennedy is in this film and is quoted out of context. Can you talk about that?
Again, Bobby Kennedy, you know, they've the Breakthrough Institute and Robert Stone have basically singled out some of the key battlefields for nuclear power. And Indian Point is one of their focuses. And, of course, Bobby Kennedy and Hudson River Keeper and the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition. Those are key groups, key individuals in this fight. So they've again painted Bobby Kennedy as an extremist. But these are all desperation moves because they leave out the most important pieces of the of an argument. Nuclear power, no matter the reactor design, cannot address climate change. It's just too expensive. You can't displace a significant amount of carbon by using fossil fuel. It's a little like talking about ending world hunger with caviar. You cannot address climate change with by nuclear power because it's just too expensive, and they're holding out for these reactor designs that are barely even on paper now with generation 4 reactors, and some of them, particularly these fast reactors that they're talking about, they've demonstrated themselves to be early failures. So they're even revisiting. I thought one of the more telling moments in the film is when they talk about their solution and referencing the integral fast reactor. The clip that they go to is so old that it's choppy and very grainy. So they're talking about solutions that were abandoned years ago because of their exorbitant risk cost, the proliferation risks, and the fact that they've had decades and not been deployed already. So these are some of the issues that we would like to bring after people see this film. We'd like to bring a dose of reality to addressing the many misrepresentations, misstatements, and false promises that the film lays out.
Okay, so we're talking with Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear about this disinfomercial sponsored by the nuclear industry. I guess they got a lot of money from Paul Allen of Microsoft, who's a buddy. Bill Gates is actually promoting new nuclear. It's important to understand, and this was intriguing to me, and then we're going to jump into Fukushima. It was intriguing to me in the Robert Stone interview, and then one that was done with Robert Stone, the director or producer of Pandora's Promise, and then with James Hansen, a climate scientist who's pushing nuclear power also. Both of them were actually very critical of the current generation of nuclear plants. Hansen referred to it as old technology, and Robert Stone referred to the current generation as 60s technology. And here these guys are out pushing new nuclear technologies. They're slamming the old stuff, and we're stuck with 400 old reactors. They want to spend money on new reactors while the house burns down. What do you think of that, Paul?
I think that it's part of the same disingenuous argument that this industry has used in many forms. First, they claimed that it was too cheap to meter, it's too expensive to matter. They called it the peaceful atom, and yet we're seeing what the consequence of, a country like Iran, who is a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, has saber-rattling all around them from the United States and elsewhere because they are pursuing the you know, nuclear power in Iran. And again, it's because of the inextricable connection. But you know, the big thing about Hansen that's never ceases to be a big puzzle for me is that Mr. Hansen has said that we have accelerating climate change now, and we have maybe a decade or less to address it before we reach a tipping point. And he's talking about bringing on nuclear power as a solution to that, but the designs that he advances are not even really complete. They're still pipe dreams in terms of reactors that can burn their own waste. These are not anywhere in a certification process. They're very much experimental, and they will not be ready in time. And so
right.
For Mr. Hansen
amazing.
To get out there and say, this is the solution, his own timeline excludes this pursuit.
Yeah, it's amazing to hear James Hansen touting his nuclear credentials and you know, ringing the alarms about global warming, and they're all talking about, which, you know, is reasonable, talking about how we have a terrible climate crisis that has to be solved very, very quickly, and yet they're advocating a technology that even under the optimum circumstances for them could have zero impact on global warming for 20 years. Even if, you know, a prototype is 8, 9, 10 years away. If it worked, which is not clear, it would take years to show that, and then it would take, you know, many, many more years to build enough of these things to make a dent. We're talking with Paul Gunter. We're down our last 10 minutes, Paul. Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear, one of the great experts and activists on nuclear power in this country. Got to talk about Fukushima now. You know, Japan has gotten the Olympics, astounding to me. And you know, Prime Minister Abe has gone on and saying no one will be harmed by Fukushima when we've already had plenty of evidence that people are dying left and right from this catastrophe soon. And I wonder if you have a time frame. The most important, what I consider, and you can tell me if I'm in hyperbole here, the most important event in human history, at least for the global environment to date, is going to come when they try and remove these fuel rods from the spent fuel pool 100 feet in the air at Fukushima Unit 4. How serious is this, and what are the odds they're going to get this done?
These are all questions that are, unprecedented right now, where we have Unit 4 at Fukushima Daiichi that has more than 150 tons of high-level nuclear waste sitting in a pool on top of a reactor building that's now leaning because of the damage from the accident. They don't really have the superstructure there right now to support the activity, and so they're fishing around for solutions in many areas. There is this need to continue to pour hundreds of tons of water onto these four wrecked units that are there. Well, three of them with melted cores somewhere in the basements of the buildings, or even perhaps beyond now in the earth, where this water then is so radioactive that it can't just be left alone. They have to pump it off. We have 1,100 tanks, 1,000 tons each, filled with water, and they're filling them all the time now to keep these reactors cool. It is an atomic age sorcerer's apprentice, and TEPCO is the Mickey Mouse, where they have lost control of an event that is now impacting the Pacific Ocean and will carry radioactive toxins up through the marine chain. Just recently, South Korea has instituted a ban on fisheries along 179 miles of the Japan eastern coast around Fukushima, South Korea will not be the last country to institute a ban on Japan fisheries, as the contamination not only from the cooling operations are failing in these reactor systems, but an aquifer coming off of the mountains of Japan and moving through groundwater under the wreckage now is carrying even another large dose of radiation as this mountain water is contaminated by the wreckage, then flows into the Pacific Ocean.
What we have is three molten reactor cores. Nobody knows where they are. Is that correct?
That's correct.
They're pouring water onto the site. They're pouring water onto the site, and they don't know where the cores are. They're just hoping to hit the cores. The water is definitely getting contaminated, pouring off the site into the ocean. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And meanwhile, and let's talk about this now because this is critical and we've only got 5 minutes left. This spent fuel pool in the air, when are they going to try and remove these spent fuel? My understanding is there are 1,300 fuel rods in this, and I've seen estimates that they contain more than 20,000 times the radiation that was released at Hiroshima. Is that possible?
It's very, very real. And again, these are estimations, but it's unforgiving the amount of radiation that are in these combined sites. And then, Sluggo, we should not forget, we're not getting news about the nuclear waste that is in a common pool to all six units that is right next to Unit 4. This leaning reactor, this leaning atomic tower of nuclear waste, right next to it, within 100 yards, is a massive spent fuel pool that has contained currently contains decades of nuclear waste from all six units. And if we have an event, another earthquake that collapses those 1,100 tanks, or simultaneously collapses the reactor buildings and exposes the reactor fuel, we could see atmospheric exposed nuclear fires that then prohibit human entry. And then we begin to see a cascade of a domino effect of nuclear accidents that could even move farther down the coast, affecting other reactors with the fallout.
Wolf, we're talking with Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear. I don't think the world has any inkling, outside of a few, maybe even just a couple thousand people, of how serious the continuing crisis is at Fukushima. Now, when they try and build a crane to remove these fuel rods, which I assume they're going to try and do in the near future, do you have any time frame on the removal of the fuel rods from Fukushima Unit 4?
We've seen operation. You know, they have moved some. They've moved a few assemblies, but these were new assemblies, so these were non-irradiated fuel. Frankly, there's not enough transparency right now to have any idea what condition that fuel is in, what condition that nuclear waste is in right now. And the Japanese are holding a lot behind this curtain as a sovereign nation, so that only recently they've begun to talk about international involvement as this nuclear accident spins further out of control. We could see a more serious effort orchestrated within the next year, but these timelines are very uncertain, and setbacks are going to be predominant, and the more radioactive that site becomes from these ongoing and increasingly greater radioactive releases, the more harder it's going to get for these operations to carry forward. I mean, some of these tank farms now, if you are close, you get a lethal dose in a couple of hours. So, you know, we're talking about site conditions already existing where human entry will be denied because of the extent of the radiation exposure.
Of course, we've already had radioactive tuna caught across off the coast of California, and the Food and Drug Administration has suspended monitoring seafood from the Pacific for radiation. Is that true?
We're trying to get the Food and Drug Administration to reinstitute food testing. This is part of any reasonable post-Fukushima world monitoring effort right now, particularly in light of the fact that we have uncontrolled releases of radioactivity going into the marine food chain.
Well, what do you think about the argument that the Pacific Ocean is so big the stuff will be diluted?
Dilution to pollution is never the solution when you have the fact that radioactivity will migrate through bioaccumulation and biomagnification. So algae gets a dose, then the little fish eat the algae, they get a bigger dose, then the bigger fish eat the little fish, they get a bigger dose, and so on. It goes up to the end of the food chain, which is us. So this is, and again, we're talking about radioactivity that will have a biological hazardous life on the order of hundreds and thousands of years. So, you can't just rely on dilution when, in fact, a natural process is for this radioactivity to biomagnify and bioaccumulate up through the food chain.
Well, on that unhappy note, we're going to have to sort of phase out here. Paul Gunter, your work has been stellar over the decades, and we're going to have to keep on. I don't know how many people are actually talking about Fukushima, but we're going to have to, because this is an apocalyptic event, and after 2.5 years, it continues to get worse. Thank God we've been shutting reactors here. We've got 99 to go in the U.S., 400 worldwide. Let's hope to God we get these shut before another Fukushima happens, and let's figure out hopefully a way to minimize the damage from Fukushima itself. Thank you so much, Paul, from Beyond Nuclear. BeyondNuclear.org is your website. I've got your petition on Pandora's Promise posted at nukefree.org. It's been another hour, another week of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, and we'll be back again next week.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.